Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Nuance Needed podcast. This is Sam Dalton, and today I am joined with the incredible Chelsea Fagan, author, founder of The Financial Diet, true legend. We met in person for the first time in the spring, and it was 10 out of 10. Loved it. Her book event was incredible. And the reason we're gathered here today is because she has another book coming out that I am so excited to explore with her. And it is called Having People Over. And it is all about community and gathering and hosting and how we can really kind of almost like resurrect the idea of gathering and community. So I am so excited to chat with you all about it. So I guess we'll get started, Chelsea. Tell us from your perspective, obviously, because you wrote this book. What is this book about to you? What does it mean to you? Let's get into it.
Yeah, so the book is Having People Over, and it is both kind of a practical guide to being both a host and a guest for all different kinds of parties and gatherings. But it is also a little bit of a manifesto on the importance of friendship and community and platonic relationships and just kind of caring for your village, especially I think in a time when we're becoming increasingly isolated and antisocial and, you know, really kind of focusing on the in-person aspect of that as well. I kind of think of social media a little bit as the methadone of community. Mm. It's just enough to keep you feeling like you have one or like you're engaging, whether that's engaging with the news or engaging with the people in your life, like you passively see them and maybe you even double tap something. But in the best cases, it's kind of often insufficient in terms of maintaining and strengthening bonds. But in the worst cases, which I think is often how it manifests, is that it, you know, the business model of social media is really kind of keeping us emotionally heightened. And the easiest, mm-hmm. cheapest way to do that is often through anger or resentment or frustration. And I think, you know, both for our own mental and social and even physical well-beings, it's important to reunite with our communities in person. But I think also in a time when we are being very deliberately estranged from each other through these kind of online portals, it's very important to remember that when we are in person, generally speaking, people are, I don't know, much kinder, more humane, more understanding, you know, even a small thing. Obviously, in the book, we talk a lot about things like dinner parties and stuff like that. But we also talk about things like in-person political meetings or mutual aid groups or, you know, these places where people are getting together and meeting each other that I think, again, is not just kind of ebbing away from how we interact with life on an individual basis, but is also really very deliberately being kept from us.
Yeah. That methadone example, as someone who used to help people obtain methadone to help with their addiction, is one of the most like spot on metaphors I think I've heard for like what social media causes us to feel in terms of like assuming we're being connected because we're engaging in DMs and we're engaging in comments and we're sharing things back and forth. But there's no substitute for the in-person connection, which is why I think so many people feel so lonely right now.
Yes. And because, you know, the kind of attention and connection that we're able to get online, again, is really designed to give us just enough to make us feel like we're just connected enough while kind of depriving us of the things that actually make us happy or fulfilled. And, you know, there's like, obviously, you know this, but there's really good psychological data around kind of the feeling that we get from, for example, over-consuming news. Like over-consuming yeah. news makes us feel like we're doing something about a problem or like we're contributing or, you know, that we're somehow sort of involved while often kind of preventing us from taking action because we're so overwhelmed and so stressed out and anxious because we're constantly consuming information, but we're not actually directing that energy anywhere. So I often say, like, I think a lot of people would be way better off, like not even reading news at all, almost, but doing at least one thing that kind of engages them with their own community and the problems that they're so concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of like identifying a lot of these issues, was that what motivated the book? Or was it more than that?
I mean, it's that, but also like I grew up very poor and my family always had, they entertained quite a bit in the home because it was more affordable. You can have potlucks, you can pull an easy dinner together, you can have people over to watch movies or play board games or do things that are a lot more financially accessible. And that is how I entertained when I was at my most, you know, financially distressed. And I think there's been this weird flipping, and we can see it in the financial data, that young people, as compared to previous generations, millennials and Gen Z, they go to restaurants way more, they go to bars way more, they order in takeout food way more. Like they are spending actually net a lot more money on these things. But yet there's sort of this perception that like having a dinner party or having people to your home is like, that's for rich and fancy people. Whereas it very much used to be the opposite. It used to be that people who didn't have much would do things in their home, and it was considered a real luxury to go out to a restaurant. So I think that also was a big motivating factor. And it's interesting, like I still see in some of the comments on, I'm doing a 30-day series about hosting and kind of drawing on some themes of the book, and especially on YouTube, where the comment section is a lot more diffuse. You know, people will often have this very defensive reaction to, you know, when I'm showing a video of like things that I cook for, you know, some invited guests that I have over, like, it's so fancy, it's so unattainable. And, you know, I think to myself, like, I'm not going to get into it in the comment section, but I'm like, baby, we're looking at some popping corn and some baked potatoes. Like, I want you to kind of release yourself from the idea that just because something feels unfamiliar or intimidating, that it inherently means it's unattainable. Like it may be easier to order DoorDash or to go out to a restaurant, but sort of convincing yourself that these things that we're showing are out of reach for you because you're not used to them or because they seem overwhelming to put together, that's not a reason to kind of gaslight yourself about the money aspect of it. And I see that happening all the time, especially as it pertains to home cooking and doing things in the home. Like we can see in the data doesn't lie, that we are now so much more desensitized to spending way more on other people doing all of this for us. And I think that that is a conversation that a lot of people, we've become so kind of hooked in by convenience and by the idea that we can't do these things ourselves, that we've started to even internalize those, our own narratives. And I don't know, I can never know whether the person commenting that, you know, a baked potato is really luxurious, but I would imagine if you looked at their budget from the past 30 days, they've probably bought a dozen things, pre-made foods that are way more expensive than that.
Right.
But again, I think we, at every turn, so many industries have built their profit models on convincing us that we can't do things, that we're better off more isolated and more dependent on them, and that these things that used to be not just accessible, but the foundation of what it meant to have a home, to have a family, to have a village, that those things are luxuries.
Well, and that I think a word that keeps coming to my mind as you've been talking, and I think even as I've watched your series, which I very much enjoy, by the way, is the word effort. And I think that is a word right now that a lot of people have very, very passionate reactions to. And I think what people forget is that effort is an ever-evolving target in our lives. Meaning the type of effort that you can give on a Saturday is not the effort you can give on a Thursday, or maybe even vice versa, depending on your schedule and your life and things that you have going on. And I think people assume that to show up and do something, like bringing people to your home and saying, I'm going to do baked potatoes, they have to assume that that then has to involve hours of prep, hours of work. It's going to take so much time for me. I have to give it my all. The house has to be this, everything. Like, I think people create all of these barriers in their mind where it's like, no, just meet yourself where you're at. Like, if baked potatoes feels too complicated for you, let people know, like, hey, I really want to host this game night. I've got too much going on to plan food. Would you mind bringing ABC? Awesome. Like, I'll cover X, right? I think people forget you get to meet yourself where you're at. And that seeing, you know, your series on social media can just be a point of inspiration. That doesn't have to be like Bible or law. Like this no. is about, this is about receiving like inspiration for like, oh, maybe I can do this. But I think people are really intimidated by that and get really overwhelmed by the idea of like, oh my God, this is one more thing I'm going to have to put effort into. Yet they say, I'm lonely. I'm struggling. I feel like I have no one I can rely on. And it's like, well, then there's going to have to be a place where you have to start somewhere. And it might not be dinner party in the Hamptons, but it might be, I'm just going to ask my friends to come over and we're just going to hang out. And that's okay.
The phenomenon that I see in people's loneliness is very similar to the one that I think you see a lot in other forms of depression, because I think, I mean, we know that loneliness is mm-hmm. just as harmful for the human body and mind as smoking, as other, you know, really, really harmful behaviors, and is also kind of becomes its own form of depression. And I think what you often see in these cycles is that the things that actually make people feel better long-term are the things that feel worse short-term. You know, like people get very defensive when someone will say, you know, exercise improves depression. Sadly, they're right. Yes, there's really not like, that's not a conspiracy. Like that's true. No. And unfortunately, like the things that will feel better in the long term are going to be the things that feel the hardest in the immediate. And there becomes a real defensiveness and almost a resentment around the implication that something that doesn't feel immediately good or easy to us is probably good for us long term. And I see the same thing with friendships and with social lives, is that the more we isolate ourselves, the more we avoid that effort, the more we don't do anything that doesn't feel good in the immediate, you know, we cancel, we say no, we don't show up, we don't reach out, you know, we don't do these things, the more we kind of convince ourselves that we don't need it, the more we become really antagonistic to it, the more it becomes almost insulting to suggest that actually being really socially isolated is really bad for human beings. And I think sometimes people will say in my videos, you know, well, I'm neurodivergent, so this doesn't apply to me. And listen, I'm not a clinician. I can't say that that's true or untrue. I'm sure there are rare cases for whom a person genuinely does not need a social life, does not need friendship, does not need a community. I'm willing to accept that that's a small but not non-existent part of the population. Generally speaking, when we're talking about like 90, 95% of human beings, we know that we need this. We know that we were designed on every level to live this way, to rely on each other, to be interconnected, to be heard and understood, to feel loved and accounted for. Like, we know this. And to me, to deny it, like, it is one thing to acknowledge that we live in an economic system that is very intentionally breaking down the community and replacing it with for-profit initiatives, a small example being childcare.
Right.
We can acknowledge that that is real. What I think is ultimate cope slash being super defensive is insinuating or outright saying that you don't need these things. And I think if people were a bit more honest with themselves about what you just said, about like this effort feels hard in the moment, and maybe sometimes you can overcome that and maybe sometimes you can't. But I think the next level of that is like accepting on a fundamental level that sometimes you have to do things that don't feel amazing in the moment.
Yes.
And that that is part of being an adult, you know? Yes. And that is what I think the vicious cycle of defensiveness that people get into about habits that are harmful to themselves, that is what I see constantly in the social stuff.
I could not agree more. And it's something that actually a lot of my clients express frustration with some of the people in their life. I'll have clients come to me and say that they tried to put something together, right? They tried to coordinate an event or do something with someone else, and they just got no, 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 no. And this frustration with people's inflexibility to just showing up the way that they can, right? And understanding that that is, it's variable from day to day, and that people are allowed to say, well, I can show up for this amount of time and then I'm going to have to leave, but I really want to make sure that I'm there. There's this sense of all or nothing thinking that I think we're seeing across every topic, issue, whatever you want to bring up. But I think when it comes to the social, I think people are assuming if they show up, it has to be everything. I have to be there for hours. I'm going to have to do something. I'm going to have to help. I'm going to have to be there. I'm going to have to be so on. They build up all of this pressure because our brain is really, really bad at predicting things because it listens to our anxiety. It listens to our fear. It listens to our concerns more than it listens to the factual data of like, no, you're just going to go. You're going to chat. You're going to sit down. You might play a game and you're going to be okay. I think this is why like I'm challenging people all the time. And even in my social media content, as I've talked sometimes about like community and reaching out, is again, just like being willing to start where you're at. It doesn't have to be this huge, big get together or thing. Exactly as you were saying with people, you know, kind of like freaking themselves out that this is going to have to be so hard and so painful and so overwhelming. And it's like, right. And you can do things that make it less that, but still show up authentically. Being honest about your time, being honest about your financial situation, being honest about, you know, maybe there are some friends that you don't really want to spend that much time with, or there's things that you would rather be doing with other people, right? You're allowed to be honest about your life. And I think that does take like an element of confidence that I think a lot of people are lacking, because exactly as you said, we all have very low tolerance now for discomfort in general, which I think is a result of all of the tech in our lives and how easy it is in some ways to exist now. Overall, like day to day to get by, we have cars, we have computers, we have delivery services. There's very low suffering. And so I think people have forgotten that to do something hard is not necessarily your suffering. Amanda and I actually had this conversation a couple of weeks ago where we talked about how there's actually two different kinds of stress. There's distress, which is bad. That would be like, you know, for your clients that are really stressed about their financial situation or digging themselves out of debt or just lost their job, right? That's really stressful, really hard. But then there's also eustress, which is good stress. And I think planning an event or getting people together or hosting something, that's good stress. It takes planning, it takes initiative, it takes, you know, responsibility, but all of that stress is in pursuit of something good for you.
People are getting way too comfortable with being losers. I gotta say that.
Thank you. I was trying to say it really nicely.
I know, you're like, you're a natural therapist. You can't be saying it like that. But when people like go off on these like diatribes in my comments sometimes about like how hard it is to like invite some friends over to watch a movie and like fucking make some popcorn or like ask them to bring over some muffins or whatever. I'm like,
it's not that hard.
What are we talking about? I really think that we need to have a serious check-in with ourselves because I understand that things sometimes might feel a little intimidating, a little uncomfortable, mm-hmm. put a little more pressure on us than we would like in the moment. But if we're at the point of feeling like socializing with our own friends or the people in our own life is like a source of, as you put it, distress and like is making us feel oppressed and like we're suffering, I'm just like, I don't know, Diva, maybe you need to like, maybe your life is way too fucking easy if that feels really, really hard. And the fact that people's response is to like lean further into that and get mm-hmm. ultra defensive and be like, well, actually for me, I can't, you know, boil some noodles and put some sauce on them. Like, it's like, I don't know. Again, like why, how and when did we get so comfortable with being like, truly adult toddlers? And I think that there is also this sort of weaponization of our own limitations, our own shortcomings, our own limiting beliefs. Like I have a very, like I have a thing that I call my like deathbed takes where I'm mm-hmm. like, if they're like about to pull the plug, like release the takes because now I have nothing to lose. Some of them I will never share. But like one of them is I feel that like middle to upper middle class, educated, otherwise functional white people love to weaponize mild versions of neurodivergence to completely abdicate responsibility and keep themselves in like a state of perpetual adolescence. Because why am I having to hear that because you have fucking ADHD, that you cannot do basic tasks of adulthood that are not only beneficial to you, your community, like you know, things that are foundational to human existence and the other people in your life who, to whom you, yes, sorry, hate to say it, owe things, but also the broader community. Our country is in a very, very rough place right now, in part because so many people who otherwise could contribute a lot to the society around them, to the community around them, are so comfortable taking their foot off the gas, totally abdicating responsibility for it, and feeling like they are completely free to just do only whatever feels comfortable for them in the immediate moment. And like, not only are you suffering as a result of that, not only are the people around you suffering as a result of that, the world that you live in is suffering because you are not stepping up. And like, people do need to draw a sense of purpose and accountability from taking care of themselves and the people around them. And I do believe, like, my most conservative, quote unquote, capital C maybe belief is that I do believe that an enormous amount of respect comes from accountability to oneself and to others. And I do feel that a lot of people, and again, often using very mild forms of neurodivergence as like a get out of jail free card for this, like feel way too fucking comfortable totally abdicating their responsibility at every single level and to not being accountable, not only again to themselves and the people in their lives, but to the world around them.
That was it, everybody. That's the show today.
That's the show.
That's it. That's all we needed to say. No, if I like take off my therapist hat, this is one of my biggest frustrations with therapy speak on social media, is because being on the autism spectrum is very real. Having ADHD is very real. And whatever other diagnosis you have, whether it's depression, whether it's generalized anxiety disorder, whether it's as far as PTSD, right? All of those things are valid. And they all have difficult symptoms that we have to get in and deal with and cope with and process. And it's hard. It absolutely adds a layer of complication to life. And I will validate that for as long as the day is long. And what I struggle with is I feel like a lot of content, most of the content, was around identifying the problems and then saying, look, you have this thing, thus you cannot do that thing. And that is where I get really frustrated, because to me, it's like, no, I don't want your life defined by these things. If there are things you want to do, I want to help you find a way around those things, respecting the fact that you have them, respecting the fact that we're going to have to meet you where you're at. Yet if you want to be social, I want us to work on how you can figure out to be social. I want to help you figure out how you can be better at time management, how you can be better at navigating the stress of social interactions. I want you to build these skills so that these things that you have in your life that impact your life do not rob you of the importance of connection and community and love and support. Sometimes when you bring that up, someone's like, well, you're asking me to do this thing that I can't do. And I'm like, can't you? Can't you? You really, truly cannot. And you become like this monster because you're putting up this challenge of like, no, why not? Especially if you have identified like, I'm lonely, I'm struggling, I want more community, I want more this, I want things in the country to change. I want to contribute. Well, guess what? Intentional action is the antidote to anxiety. And if you want to feel better about your life, you are going to have to do things for you that may be new, that you've never done before, that you've never tried, and you might have to figure out, kind of bumping your shins along the way, what a new version of you looks like.
I think it's even more sinister than that, honestly. I think that two things. One, do I think being, I don't know, having ADHD or like being on the autism spectrum on a, you know, more on a lower needs end, or like me having like diagnosed anxiety, whatever. Do I think these things like make certain things harder? Sure. Do I think it makes it harder than like, I don't know, a person who's maybe completely neurotypical, but like, is like supporting their ailing parents at home, or like has a bunch of kids as a single mom, or like is working two jobs, or like physical disabilities, or any of these other things. It's like, I'm going to go out here and say it's hard for most people. I'm going to go out here and say most people have limitations. Most people have a hard time with things. Most people don't have a lot of time, money, and energy to go around. Like, so I just don't even necessarily know that we should be in the business of like I don't know, ranking what makes it harder for us to like show up and be a contributing adult. But second of all, I think the more sinister element of a lot of this as it pertains to community, like I was talking in a recent video about how like being the person who never states a preference does not make you easygoing. It makes you burdensome. Like you've just put the work onto everyone else consistently to figure everything out, to plan everything, to make a decision, whatever. Like you're not, it's not the sleigh you think it is. But kind of like on that note, like so much of this stuff about more sort of like behaviorally oriented things, I find in a lot of this conversation around neurodivergence as it pertains to the world around you, what you owe to other people, what you can bring to other people, I find that there is this sort of recurring undertone. And it's also only with certain mental health stuff, right? Because like there's also like the bad ones where we've sort of like designated that actually you're the problem and you're evil or whatever. Like people have like NPD or BPD or whatever.
Right.
But with a lot of this stuff, I find this undertone of like, I get to do what I get to do. And if you take issue with it, if you don't like it, if you don't want to be friends with me anymore as a result, if you put up boundaries around it, actually, that's you being ableist. That makes you the bad person. I get to do whatever I want. And it's like, baby, like, I don't know how to tell you this, but like, you get to have whatever you have, but like, it's kind of all of our responsibility to get on with each other. If your mental health stuff manifests in you just being a really shitty friend consistently, being really unpleasant to be around, unreliable, unaccountable, if it makes you all those things, like people aren't going to want to hang out with you. And that doesn't make them ableist. That makes them a normal person who has every right to have basic minimum standards for how they're treated. And I do find that there is this sort of flipping of the accountability. Like at the end of the day, like at every concentric circle, community is what we have, right? Like we have the community of our home, of our offices, of our extended families, our neighborhood, our country, whatever. It is the individual's job to adapt to the community, not the other way around. That is how life works. Mm-hmm. And I do think that in America in particular, like we have been so like individualism brainwormed that we think it's the other way around. It is not.
No. So the episode that we just dropped pretty recently was my story talking about my brother who has severe disabilities. He's 32 years old, but mentally he functions at about like 2.5. And my parents are his full-time caregivers, and I still am as well. I go home frequently to help out. I helped care for him when I was younger. And what I shared in that episode was, as hard as that was, it taught me how important it is to get outside of yourself sometimes. And for me to realize that, like, as hard as it was, and as hard as it is sometimes, right, to be there and to help and to change diapers and to change beds and to help keep him entertained and keep him happy and help him navigate meltdowns, right? Like, I survive it every time. I come out and we still have good memories. We still have good times. We like come together as a family. It's brought us closer. And I think people forget that about struggle, is that struggle and challenge to any level that you're ascribing it is not inherently bad. It's just a function and feature of existing. And what made it possible for me to like work through my own trauma of being a caregiver my whole life was to accept that, like, no, I'm actually really proud of the effort that I've put in to my family. I'm actually really, really proud of how I've showed up for this responsibility and for how I've showed up for this. And there's a lot of strength that comes with that. And to be willing to make necessary sacrifices in pursuit of something that is outside of yourself and something that can feel thankless and something that nobody is coming in and giving you a medal for. But I do it because I love him and I care about him and he is an important part of my family. Now, I understand that's like an extreme example, but I think in some ways it's not. To take the theme of your book, like having people over, showing up for people, opening up your home, like how to be a good friend and a good neighbor, right? How to be thoughtful, how to be intentional. I really want to like push people to think of like, how can I push myself outside of my comfort zone to show up for others? Mm-hmm. I think we are spending way too much time thinking about what do I need, which like to a point is important, right? It's a part of the equation, but social media would have us believe that is the entire equation, that I just have to do what is best for me. And to a point, yes, but it is inevitable that at some point you will need to sacrifice for somebody else to contribute to and add to a sense of community. And that you will have to be inconvenienced. You will have to be put out. You might have to show up in a way that doesn't feel convenient for you. And I even made a post about this a couple weeks ago where I also said, you know, my bad day is not my friend's problem. For example, if I have told my friend, I want you to reach out to me, I want you to let me know when you're having a hard time, or I want to be there for you, or I want to do this. If I have established that foundation and I'm having a rough day and that friend then reaches out to me, I have two choices. I can either say, hey, I am so sorry. Today is insane. Can we circle back tomorrow? Like I will be reaching out to you tomorrow, Tuesday, whatever, right? Or I might have to put my stuff aside in pursuit of showing up for this person the way that I told them I would. And I think there's a world where people have assumed that that means we're abandoning ourselves, when in fact, what we're doing is we're living up to our values. And nowhere in that moment did we say, well, now I'm not important at all because this person has just become so much more important than me. No. It's about saying, well, my values say I want to show up for my community. I want to be a good friend. So that means I'm just going to put my stuff over here. I'll get to it later. And I'm going to show up for my friend over here.
Okay, so if you're listening to this episode and feeling like, oh my gosh, I could actually really use a therapist, we've got you. My practice, Therapy for Women Center, has therapists licensed in 43 states across the country. This is also where Sam and I work. So if you're interested in working with one of us, reach out to us at therapyforwomencenter.com. And if we aren't a fit, like I said, we have therapists who can definitely help you. All the therapists are hired by me, trained by me, handpicked by me, and we really back and support our therapists. We vouch for them, unlike some of these big online therapy platforms. Also, if you're local to the Philadelphia area, we have 3 office locations there. So I would love for you to go to our website, therapyforwomencenter.com, and check it out.
It also is like, it's friendship is an investment, right? Like,
yes,
you're also investing in them doing the same for you. You're investing in having people who care about you. There are a lot of sort of like tests of how we measure community in terms of like how many people know your middle name, would notice if you're not there, would ask about you. How many people know this information about you, care about it, follow it? Like, there are so many ways in which community sort of becomes an invisible infrastructure of our lives. And these relationships that we've created and invested in give something back to us all throughout, you know, again, even sometimes in ways we may not notice. Something as simple as, you know, someone saying something nice on your behalf when you're not there. Like, those are all of sort of the invisible cobwebs of what a community that you invest in means. So there is a sort of selfish aspect to it as well in that sense. But, you know, when you talk about your brother and, you know, caring for someone who is profoundly disabled and will never change in that regard, like, you're also describing what I think is the biggest anxiety of these conversations, which is a relationship that is not reciprocal.
Right.
Your brother will never be able to reciprocate even Mm-mm. a small fraction of what you have done for him.
Mm-mm.
He will never be able to articulate it or probably ever even understand it fully.
Right.
And that is probably the most extreme example of that kind of sacrifice. And I do understand on the one hand that people have anxiety about doing something that is not reciprocated. And I think mm-hmm. another lesson to take there is that that is the risk of loving. That is the risk of being a good person. That is the risk of being generous and kind, is that sometimes it will not be reciprocated. It's a small thing, but like, I have, you know, I do events for these books and I have a person that I thought I had like connected with in a meaningful way through professional stuff. I invited her to 2 events. One she RSVP'd to and then never showed up to, and the other she just never RSVP'd to, and I had to track her down, and she said, oh, I forgot. No, I'm not coming. Oof. And, you know, I thought, like, did I feel kind of, you know, a little hurt, a little embarrassed, rejected, all of those things? Sure, of course I did. But like, yeah, I'm taking the L on that one. I'm taking the L. Like, I thought that she was someone that I would maybe foster a better connection with and kind of make the leap from like professional acquaintances to maybe one day friends.
Yeah.
That will not be happening. And I think, and it's okay. Like I, you know, I understand that like, that is like, I put, I put myself out there. I showed an interest in her. I even like sent her things. I'm like, I put myself out there in a way that was not reciprocated.
Yeah.
And that hurts. But I also understand that like part of taking the L on that and accepting that that's like part of the game is that like so many of the most valuable relationships I do have are because I am the kind of person who will put myself out there, who will invite you, who will include you, who will want you in her life and risk the vulnerability of saying that. And I do think that this hyper focus on perfect reciprocity often robs us of being the most loving and lovable versions of ourselves, you know, especially in a time where we are always focused on, you know, not being too invested, being nonchalant, you know, not caring, all of those things, to be the person who shows up. You know, I think there are so many layers to the glass child stuff, this, the child that, you know, has to care for their sibling. I have close friends in my life who are in a very similar dynamic. And I think often it can become, you know, a really unfair and unhealthy dynamic for the siblings who are the caregivers. But I do think in the most sort of healthy or optimistic iteration of it, it is giving you, the most high level version of that lesson is that like, sometimes we have to love others, even if we're not necessarily going to get it back in the same way, you know, by the way, the thing men famously don't do when their wives get sick on aggregate, the thing they famously do not show up for.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. In fact, they file divorce papers. That's what they do, which is that, ever since I was in grad school, my first,
I fully believe if one day I'm dictator, I think I'm making, I would like to make a law where if women have given their whole lives to their husband and then they get diagnosed with some terminal or highly disabling illness and the husband leaves them, she should be able to kill him legally. Like neither of us is making it out of this illness alive.
No, like, no. If we all make choices and there's natural consequences to all of your choices. Yes.
I genuinely, like I've thought about that. Like, and I, you know, listen, I feel pretty strongly and confidently that my husband is the kind of person who would care for me truly through sickness or health, but you never know. So I have said very clearly, if I get diagnosed with a terminal illness and you like run off with some nurse or whatever, like who's caring for me, I just know that I will be murdering you. I will not let you or her, honestly. Well, I don't know. She can maybe live. I like maim her. But like you, sir, will be dying. Because if I'm already like about suffering to die, what do I have to lose?
For legal reasons, we are not condoning that. But in Chelsea's dream world, that is where we are at.
Yes. And that will be what happens.
There has to be. My whole dream world would be there has to be some type of punishment for that. There has to be something like there has to be some type of deliverable, immediate karmic return if you leave.
Murder.
Your wife. Yeah. Fair. You know what? You are correct. That's pretty usual.
An eye for an eye, Sam. An eye for an eye.
I know. I need to. Sometimes I need to take off my therapist hat more often. But no, I really appreciate how you described that example of investing in what you thought would be a friendship and having it not pan out. Because what I hear in that and what I remind, you know, the people that I work with, and I think even my online community, what I try to remind them of is like, that moment for you was not a loss because you behaved 100% authentically to you and what matters to you and what is important to you. And that not being returned is not an indication of you. It's an indication of that other person. It's really like dating. Like sometimes when you think of like friendship and connection, it's like dating. You're going to have some people that you're like, oh, like get away from me. You're going to have people that you find kind of like this soulmate connection and it's amazing and it's perfect and it meshes and it's lovely. And then you're going to have a million places in the middle. And some people are going to fall in that, but you have to try in order to figure out where people are going to fall on that spectrum for you and to eventually land on people that are going to reciprocate when they're able. And also the other thing too, in terms of reciprocation, is like boundaries are meant to be malleable. Boundaries are not brick walls. And I think when people think of this idea of reciprocating or giving and not getting anything back, that sets off like that immediate social media therapy speak of like, I'm being taken advantage of and I have to do something and I have to protect myself. And it's like, in some situations, absolutely, right? Like, sure. If someone tries to take advantage of you or do something cruel to you or God forbid something illegal, right? Obviously, we're going to have a couple of brick walls. But for the most part, if you do something for someone that is not reciprocated, what is going on in their life? What are they actually capable of right now? Have they reciprocated to you in the past? Did they express like a deep sense of appreciation for what they did, if they're able to? Did you feel that you invested in something that you want to be investing in? And I think people really forget that it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be the same situation every single time. It gets to be different. And that doesn't mean you're being taken advantage of. That doesn't mean you've allowed a boundary to be crossed. That doesn't mean someone is manipulating you. It literally can just be you did something nice and you did it because that mattered to you. End of story.
Also, like, we need to accept that, like, we're assholes too. You know, yes, we do stuff that hurts other people too. We can also drop the ball and do. And I think that that is the other aspect of a lot of this sort of very self-focused therapy culture, like that really is so unhealthy, is it's like so often focused on like when you're the victim, you're the oppressed, you're being acted upon, you. And it's like always that joke of like, the worst person you know is in therapy right now being told they're a people pleaser. I have a friend who's like been caught in like a bit of a DeLulu cycle with dating. We're kind of like living the same story over and over. And like our framing of it to ourselves is very much like they're the problem. And they can also be the problem. But like, I'm seeing a very clear problem on this side of the fence too. And a serious sort of like misapprehension of the situation. And like, as a friend, like there are ways that you can kind of allude to that. There are ways that you can kind of like try to gently suggest that direction of more introspection and more kind of self-criticism in a way that's healthy. But a lot of times, like people, I think, as it pertains to the community and as it pertains to our social relationships, be they romantic, platonic, or otherwise, again, we are in a cultural context in America that at every turn pushes us toward what is the individual feel like, think, want, and is very sort of oriented around our preferences and our feelings and our perception of situations. When I take a step back to what it means to really prioritize community in your life and to really prioritize others, is to think first and foremost about how we are making others feel. You know, how are other people perceiving our actions and our intentions, which I think we've often been told is unhealthy or too sort of dismissive of ourselves. And it can be, for sure. There are people who become hyper obsessed with how they are perceived or what have you.
Right.
But we have to accept that that is not how our culture orients us. And it's certainly not how our economy orients us. And I think that there is often much more value. Like, we know that it makes people happier to give gifts than to receive them, for example. And I do think we often underestimate the value and the long-term happiness and fulfillment that it brings to really try to orient our behavior and choices around being a wonderful part of community that people want to be around.
Absolutely. And a role that I realized that I played for a long time was that I was the gatherer. I was the one that threw the parties and the holiday parties and the get-togethers and the this, and I planned that and I planned this. And there was a long time where I did struggle with like a sense of resentment that nobody else was really doing that. And I was like, well, why? Like, I don't understand. And then I kind of said to myself, you know what? Like, I'm actually really proud of the fact that I do that. And I think even though for me, I'm the one putting forth, quote unquote, the mental effort, I like to do that. And at the time I was doing that, I was in the position in my life where I had the time flexibility to do that. And that even though I had a very difficult job at the time. I was working in the emergency room and it was very draining. I actually needed to be putting in that effort to be social outside, even though it was work, even though it took time and planning and coordination and all that. I needed to be investing that effort in something different that made me feel like a human. And I started to see my ability to plan and bring people together as like, no, that's what I like to do. I'm not going to be offended that somebody else doesn't do that or doesn't think of doing that. I'm just going to accept that that's who I am. That acceptance of like looking at yourself for who you are and embracing that because that's you, not because it might be something bad or it might be something that you might be taking advantage of. You know what? Because I'll tell you straight, I have had people take advantage of me. Absolutely. That is part of being alive. That is the risk of having friends. That's the risk of having connection. And that's our individual job to navigate that, but to then reorient around, well, what is in fact important to me? I refuse to let this outside person dictate what I do or don't do in my life simply because they behaved a certain way. I think that's something that gets like lost in the sauce, is that to like something or enjoy something that might on the surface be not for you does not mean you are doing something that is like harming yourself.
To me, being a facilitator, especially in our current cultural moment, is the most powerful thing you can be. It's actually way more advantageous to you in the long term to be the facilitator, to be the gatherer, even if it's never quite reciprocated, because like it's kind of the same thing as like, you know, whoever takes notes in the meeting has the power. If you're the person who connects people, who facilitates those connections, who creates moments of gathering, who, you know, puts people in advantageous positions, like who introduces friends, who does all these things, like that gives you an enormous amount of power, connection, access in so many ways, big and small. This is something that I struggle with a lot as a child-free person when it comes to mothers. I think that we have this weird sort of cultural mandate that all mothers are good mothers, for example. We're accepting of the fact that there's like, there's plenty of shitty dads, and we love talking about shitty dads. The broader point for me, as it pertains to any identity, is you actually don't get to decide if you're a good one of those things. You don't get to decide if you are a good relational term. You don't get to decide, like your partner decides if you're a good partner. Your child decides if you're a good parent. Your friend decides if you're a good friend. And I think that a lot of times we get very defensive over these sort of identity terms and really want this ownership over them. But a lot more of us need to be aware that like the accounting of our life will often be told at our funeral by who's even there, by who shows up. It is determined by the way we make others feel, the place that we give, that we accord them in our lives, the way that we show up for them, the way that we listen to them, are present for them, accept them. You know, like you don't get to be a good X, Y, and Z if you don't even fundamentally accept people for who they are, you know? And that is the case of, to take it back to parents, how many of you guys feel like good parents to the children that you don't even like accept their gender or sexuality fully?
Yep.
I think at the end of the day, like there is a very strong desire in all of us. We know that we want these things. We know that we want to be loved. We know that we want people around us. We know that we want people to care about us, to listen to us, to ask after us. Unfortunately, that is not a thing that you can demand. That is not a thing that you can self-assert. It is a thing that you build. It is a thing that you earn. It is a thing that other people must choose to give you. And that is where I think at the end of the day, the investment part comes in. And if you, to take it back to the beginning of our conversation, are at a place where you feel oppressed at the idea of having to like accord time, space, and effort for your friends, you don't deserve friends, unfortunately. And that is the reality. You are not a good friend. And you don't get to claim that title without ever putting in any of the effort that the title requires.
I really very much appreciate that you brought all that up, because every other week I host a group through, there's a therapist that she has a group called Calling Home. Her name's Whitney Goodman. She's Sit With Wit on Instagram. And she has this group called Calling Home where people are able to, it's support groups for people with estranged family dynamics. And every other week I facilitate the group Adult Daughters of Difficult Mothers. And every week, I have anywhere from 25 to 35 women, or every other week, I mean, coming in and talking about some of the most gut-wrenching relationships that they have with these women who birthed them. And it is so empowering to hear them talk about like the pain and the rejection and the hurt and all of the stuff that this relationship has put them through and trying to navigate that and the grief that comes with that, while also them leaning into the realization that they get to build their own communities and families. They have all individually in their healing work found people that have helped fill that space, not replace it, but have helped fill that void of love, connection, acceptance, support through people in their lives, through friends, through extended family members, through friends that did become family, right? People that families were very kind and almost essentially bringing them in as a family member and treating them as such. And I think that is why community matters so much. It is so healing and it is so nurturing when you had such a troubled, painful, abuse and neglect filled childhood, to be able to turn that around and say, no, I am deserving of these things. And look at all of the people who can give me these things. To stand in that and to realize that you can wrap yourself in love without it having to look like the stereotypical vision that people think it is, of like, well, I have to have a relationship with X and Y parent. I have to have a relationship with X and Y sibling. I have to have a relationship with X and Y grandparent. No. It's exactly as you said. You get to have relationships with people that reciprocate to you. And that doesn't matter who it is, right? Especially if you are the one over there trying to be giving and kind and take accountability and build and nurture the relationship. If someone is refusing to engage in that, you get to move on. Doesn't matter who it is. And I just think that that's a really, really powerful reminder of why community and gathering and building and investing in these things is so important, because it gives you a cushion to land when something doesn't work out.
One thing that I've really understood as I've gotten older is that we never know, we'll never be able to know what love feels or looks like in someone else's mind and body. And it's never, ever a useful or helpful exercise to try and compare or rank order forms of love. The truth is, it is one of those things that will always remain completely subjective and completely unknowable. But to that point, we are so indoctrinated into the idea that certain loves surpass all inherently, whether that's romantic love above platonic, children above other forms of connection, even sometimes biological versus non-biological, which is a whole other can of worms and part of why I really don't like that whole framing. But like, there are so many different forms of love, and we live in a world that sort of rank orders them, which leads us to feel so defective if we don't fall into that rank order. Our experience isn't that. So many people who don't care for and nurture relationships as they should and as they owe the other person use those sort of titles and use those cultural assumptions about how we relate to each other as essentially cover for any kind of mistreatment. I would venture to say most mothers who have mistreated their children, neglected, abused, disrespected their children will simultaneously tell them they love them more than life itself, and they'll never be able to understand how much they love them. But similarly, how many men don't treat their wives with true care, respect, and partnership, and yet will offhandedly refer to her as like my best friend or like whatever, will offhandedly say how much they love her. Do you? Is that love a practice? And so to your point, the community, the true relationships that matter, they are the ones that we both invest in and the ones that invest in us. And we need to get over the idea that it is necessarily by definition going to be certain people in your life. It's the people who you make it, and it's the people who show up in return.
I love that you brought up the different types of love, because I agree. I think as someone who is both single and childless, my friendships have been everything to me. Those connections have carried me through and given me purpose and meaning and support and love in my life. And I think there is so much socialization of, well, those are different. Right? Those are like, those are placeholders until you get to the real love. And it's like, no, I come with baggage. Like when I find my man, wherever he is, like there is a group of women behind me that are coming with me. And those women have contributed and added to my life, just as I hope you will. right? But yeah. you are not a replacement for that community. You are an addition totally. To my community. And I have that as a standard. And I think even in my family, you know, I've been very lucky in my family that there were a couple years, about a decade ago, where we really didn't like each other. And I've been very lucky that my mom showed up for me and she went and did her work and I went and did my work and we hashed it out and we're now in a good place. And that is what I deem as a good mother, right? Like someone who was willing to acknowledge their weakness and do better. Right. And I think that's what so many people don't realize, whether you're a mother, you're a father, you're an aunt, you're an uncle, a grandparent, a friend, I don't care what a coworker, I don't care what the situation is. You at any point can take accountability for the pain that someone has brought to your doorstep. I think so many people deeply overestimate how easy it is to start the road of repair. And I think if you are feeling like you are in a position in your life where maybe you've burned some bridges, maybe you're feeling that some things are too far gone. You don't know unless you try. You don't know unless you invest. You don't know if you never go lay your mea culpa at their feet, you don't know how they might be back to you. And I tell my clients this all the time. You can't assume people will know your needs. You cannot assume people will read your mind. You have to communicate it to them. You have to be willing to practice that vulnerability in building community and maintaining community by acknowledging, hey, there's a disconnect in this relationship, and taking that ownership, either even if your part is the small part of it or if your part is the big part of it. But I think if you're listening to this and you're feeling all sorts of feels, either because you realize maybe you've neglected some relationships or maybe because you're realizing there's someone that's neglecting your relationship and your love, you will not know if it is possible to repair and rebuild that if you don't try. And I think that is maybe like the sum of like this whole conversation is you have to try. You have to be prepared to do things differently if you want your life to look differently.
I agree.
With that said, to round this all out, is there a part of the book that you are most excited for people to dive into?
Probably the content on how to be a good guest, because I think that is really where we're showing the most slippage these days. Like if you're already going through the effort of hosting, you're probably doing fine.
If you're already thinking of having people over, you're good. I'm so excited for this book. I have ordered my copy. And if you want to let everybody know where they can find you, where the book is coming out, what would you like people to know?
I'm at Fagan Chelsea on Instagram and TikTok. It'll be out October 21st, wherever books are sold. I am also going on tour with William Sonoma, which you can also find on my social media. Yeah, we're going to be cooking some recipes from the book and doing signings. And it's
lovely. Well, thank you so much for your time, Chelsea. You are a legend and an icon.
Thank you.
As per usual, everybody, if you love this episode, if you could rate, review, share, subscribe, that would mean the world to us. We love every single one of you. Also, Nuance Needed is over on Substack, and we are going to be dropping a synopsis of this episode over there with a little bit of a guide attached to it. And so, yeah, until next time. Bye.
Bye, guys.